Blog Talk Radio.
Believe it or not, even though Trump is the worst president in history and a worse leader than Stalin and Hitler combined, little Kim actually said that he's going to back off. He's not going to shoot missiles towards Guam, but he's going to wait and see what is done by the fill-in-the-blank insults Americans. So how much credit is Donald Trump getting for this? Zero. Why is that? Because the left is infatuated with its own ideas. And because of that, it will not give any credit to any victories by Trump, any breakthroughs. And the reason ultimately is because it wasn't their idea. And so even going through YouTube right now, I don't find there is the story itself in the Wall Street Journal. North Korea backs off Guam missile attack threat. That is giant news. It's giant news because they were talking about doing something that would result in the possible creation of World War III. And yet I'm literally seeing no stories on this in YouTube, which is completely bizarre. And I just see story after story about a possible war with so I go to the next page. I see one story about it from Associated Press, although this news has been out since yesterday. So here's what Associated, the only story that I can actually find on a video. God bless Associated Press from yesterday.
That he has taken a look at their plans, as he said.
Ray Tenorio, the governor of Guam, or pardon me, lieutenant governor.
And we'll be holding off on, at least it appears to be imminent threats to Guam at this point. There doesn't appear to be any indication that, based on what we're hearing, that there will be any missiles attacking in the near future or in the distant future. We're happy that the rhetoric is starting to calm down, perhaps, from Kim Jong-un, and not at least pursuing at the moment his threats to fire missiles at Guam. Nobody wants any confrontation beyond the peace that we enjoy today on this resort destination. So we want to continue to see our tourism grow. We want to continue to see the peace and stability of our region. And we stand behind our president and our country and our secretaries of defense and state with respect to holding the Pyongyang government accountable for whatever they do.
All right. So how about this? Donald Trump saw this game that Kim Jong-un was playing, and he decided to finally respond to it. And basically, he read the situation correctly and put out the appropriate response that then resulted in this guy backing off. So why isn't it the headline of every single, I still see stuff at brand new CBS News, North Korea details Guam attack plan, et cetera, et cetera, on all the different networks. Why can't they give him any credit? They supposedly, the media is concerned about Trump because they care about America, right? That's the premise. So that is, that premise doesn't really seem to be working out because they don't really appear to be rewarding Trump doing well. All they're doing is trying to egg him on and antagonize him. So, in any event, well done, Donald Trump. Although anybody on the left is going to say it was an accident. It was that going to happen anyway. That Kim Jong-un finally found somebody that was crazier than him. All right, so there was an Oklahoma man that was accused of plotting to bomb. And here's a little bit on that from CBS.
City this morning accused of plotting a bomb attack on American soil. Authorities say 23-year-old Jerry Drake Varnell tried to blow up what he thought was a vehicle bomb at a bank in Oklahoma City. It is just blocks from the site of the 1995 bombing that killed 168 people at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Omar Villafranca is at the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum. Omar, good morning.
Good morning. Federal officials say Varnell was upset with the government and planned to use a device similar to the one used in the domestic terror attack here more than 20 years ago. According to court documents, a confidential informant alerted the FBI to Varnell's alleged plan. The informant then introduced Varnell to an undercover FBI agent posing as someone who could help him get bomb-making supplies and plan the attack. Varnell then helped assemble what he thought was a 1,000-pound bomb made from ammonium nitrate. He was arrested overnight Saturday when he tried to detonate it at the Bank First Building in downtown Oklahoma City. Varnell reportedly had mental health issues. On his Facebook page, Cade Varnell, a user claiming to be the suspect's brother, posted this comment: "My brother is schizophrenic, and the FBI brought him the van loaded with explosives. Good job, America." But federal officials say they gave Varnell multiple chances to pull out of the attack. If convicted, he could face up to 20 years in prison. Gail?
Thank you very much, Omar.
All right, so who knows what that was about. I guess we'll find out more about it. Now, there is a story about Steve Bannon. Everybody at this point knows that he's associated with Breitbart and that he is associated with, in one form or another, the alt-right. And according to some sources, was instrumental in Donald Trump winning his election. So here's a little bit on the idea that they're going to remove him.
White House staff shakeup could leave Steve Bannon on the outside. Sources tell CBS News President Trump's chief political strategist may soon be gone.
The former executive chairman of Breitbart News helped Mr. Trump win the presidency, but his future is at risk because the president's new chief of staff is working to restore order in the West Wing. Major Garrett is at the White House. Major, good morning.
Good morning. We can report through various and several sources, high place sources inside and outside the White House, that chief strategist Steve Bannon has never been in more jeopardy. And one well-placed source tells us he could be gone by the end of this week. Now, Bannon's stock has risen and fallen like other senior White House officials, and he has survived job scares before. His close personal relationship with the president can't be ruled out, but his fate is the topic of intense internal discussions involving the president and inside and outside advisors, in part because Bannon's history of clashing with members of the national security team, as well as top economic advisors. He's also accused of using his allies in the conservative media to try to undermine H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor. Now, the new chief of staff here at the White House, retired four-star Marine General John Kelly, is trying to eliminate that kind of open factional warfare within the White House. And he has also tried to strengthen McMaster's position within the White House. And there's an ideological dimension to this as well. Bannon's hard right nationalist economic perspective and his reluctance to engage or expand military operations makes him clash with comparatively more moderate voices in the White House. In the end, this could come down to the president's newly forged relationship with Kelly. Several sources tell us that Kelly wants more adults in the White House, and where Bannon falls on Kelly's estimation of adult, not adult, could decide his fate. Gail?
All right, Major, thank you very much.
Well, so to be continued. Now, I found it. I found a whole bunch of clips for you last night, and then I stumbled onto one that I thought was really kind of remarkable. As opposed to trashing the alt-right and the Charlottesville killer, I mean, I think that it's pretty obvious that the guy was off of his rocker and represents a movement that is totally unacceptable. Now, one of the statements is going to be that Trump misread the situation and gave the wrong speech, but here's a little bit of his follow-up.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America. Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
All right, so now, I mean, I think it is ridiculous to call a president a racist, but I mean, it's going to be the position of the left that he's obviously a racist, or he wouldn't have somebody like Bannon in there. And neo-Nazis have cited that the president, they like the president, whatever. But I found this clip and I was trying to think, it's how do you get inside of the disaffection that many people in this country feel, especially, dare I say, white people? I found a great interview and I wanted to play some of it and see what you thought of. I got into some clips on the problem of poverty in America. And so in the last 10 years, the country, I think, has slipped quite a bit financially or economically. And I would, you know, lay it at the feet of an administration, in part, an administration that was totally infatuated with red tape for the sake of red tape, in the same way that this town is, trying to slow down growth to fight global warming or whatever, you know, fight against capitalism. But I think that there's other things going on, globalism, the development of foreign markets. There's a lot of things going on that have led to the development of it. But I think there are many people in the country that feel as if the best days of America, at least for their family, are in the past. So we'll come back and talk about that. Here is from The Last Waltz, supposedly the greatest concert movie ever with the band, Bob Dylan's band. Van Morrison's Caravan.
Here we go.
All right, so I was kind of thinking about what is at the root of some of the dissatisfaction in America beyond the white nationalism or Black Lives Matter or whatever. There's this kind of racial thing going on, and I think that part of it has to do with, you know, what's the old saying? Success has 1,000 fathers, and failure is an orphan. So economic success makes everybody happy, and then poverty is is something that's difficult for people to deal with, especially in a place like America where there's supposed to be an unlimited amount of opportunity. So let me get to some headlines first. You've got Guam radio stations sparking a terror by accidentally broadcasting nuke warning. Can you imagine that? You're listening to the radio, and they're talking about the nuclear bombs are coming. You're living on Guam. There's no place to drive to. Homicide detectives probing man's overdose death at home of prominent Dem donor in California. The guy's name is Buck, and he got off on getting young black men, this is a white guy, young black men to take crack or whatever, smoke meth. And one of the people that he was paying to do this, and I think they were doing it in the nude type of a thing. There was some, you know, perverse thing going on that one of the kids that he had hired from, who had flown over from Texas, had OD'd, so right after he got there. What do you think of the pardon for Sheriff Joe Arpaio? Protesters toppling Confederate statues in North Carolina. Do you think that history should be cleansed? Do you think that all of these statues and the flags and everything should be removed? There's two arguments. One is, if you leave them up, it's a celebration of slavery. Another, on the other side, it is that history is full of everything, not just the things that you approve of. And that it's wrong to get rid of things from the past because we can also learn from those. According to Gallup, president's numbers down to 34%. And so I don't see hear anybody celebrating this little Kim backing off. Home Depot setting records in sales, and so the boom, the building boom is going on. Kid Rock may not be eligible for Michigan ballot as Kid Rock, but under his other name, so he'll have to get signatures for that. Iran is sending a warship to the Atlantic. Big Ben, the clock is being silenced in England because it's too noisy. Now, here's a story that seems to be repeating one way or the other. Woman kills dogs, burns house down, or pardon me, woman stabs dog, starts fire in an effort to get rid of evil spirits. And this is in Pittsburgh. A woman killed, it says a direct quote here, a woman killed, stabbed her three dogs. I assume she killed them by stabbing them and started a fire in Bright Heights home Friday morning. And by the way, Frankie, please stop sending those obnoxious texts. Frankie's texts are like in a different language and always include an insult of the president with lacking any intellectual content. So anyway, this lady goes and stabs her dogs, which is not funny, but it's so bizarre, and then lights the house on fire. So actually, I've got a little clip here from this, and this is from CBS Local in Pittsburgh. Check this out.
Stabbing spree. First responders were called to put out a fire, and inside they found three animals stabbed.
Neighbors say the violent rampage is a desperate plea for help. Bob Allen joins us live to explain. Bob.
Well, David, this is a very sad story about an elderly woman who we're told has severe mental illness. Now, her house is badly damaged. Two of her pets died in a tragedy that one neighbor says should have been prevented. Police and firefighters were called to this home on Brandon Road in Brighton Heights, where they found a fire burning inside and 3 dogs with stab wounds. Paul Clems says an elderly woman who lives there has been suffering from severe mental illness. He called 911 after she knocked on his door.
She had a gash on her hand, and she was shaking and crying, and said that she had to get out of her house, and she had to set the house on fire to get rid of evil spirits. And she had to stab the dogs that were attacking her.
This may have been an intentionally set fire by the female occupants of this house.
One of the dogs died inside the residence. The other 2 were taken to a local treatment facility where another one died. Clems calls it a tragedy that should have never happened. And he says it's one of many examples of the breakdown in care for people with mental illness.
This woman was in Mercy about a month ago. They sent her home. And this was after she had been in UPMC and I think Mercy one other time.
Clem sends his sympathies out to the woman's family, but he says society needs to figure out how to improve the treatment, saying she should have been supervised and on medication.
I'm old enough to know when we had Dixmont and Mayview and a few other places, and then they shut them all down.
Okay, so anyway, kind of leads back into what I was talking about. But let's get some I want to get into the idea that one of the things, and this would be an idea that any Marxist, any socialist would embrace with joy, the idea that poverty is setting loose demons into the society that people are then reacting to with ideas like white nationalism, which, you know, doesn't come from nowhere. 631-523-1450 to call in. We'll be right back. Here's your local news.
Yellow cow there is painted red and white. Tell me who's everybody's staying overnight. Yes, the velvet 74 round of chill by a singing bass. Yeah, the mama told us.
Now, this guy that got fired by Google, James Damore, ended up going on to the show of the guy that we listen to here occasionally, Jordan Peterson, and also another person by the name of Stephen Molyneux. And there's an article criticizing all of this development in The Guardian, but I think that the UK Guardian... The interesting thing is, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, kind of a deeper understanding to this. The, you know, it's not, you know, white nationalism is not happening in a vacuum. You've got to put in there also Black Lives Matter. If white nationalism is racism, then isn't Black Lives Matter by definition a racist response? Isn't black separatism the black equivalent of white nationalism? They're both asking for their own homeland. They're both condemning the other parties. So here is this video that I was listening to last night. That here's a little introduction from American Enterprise Institute. It's a guy by the name of Charles Murray, who's written on a lot of interesting. He's basically a sociologist writing on the issues, a lot of the issues such as these. But I think that there, you know, people. So if you listen to James Damore, he had put out this memo at Google to try to make the place better. And he was in favor of more inclusivity, including more opinions. He felt like Google was a cult, which he said after he got fired, but he got fired for putting this memo out. And so you see, and he was criticizing the leftist slant of Google. And it is impossible to not conclude that the left has its own religion, its own sacred ideas, its own Ten Commandments or scriptures, in which political correctness is part of it, in which it seems obvious that the, you know, white people or white males, I guess you would say, are one of the main evildoers in the story, you know. So here is a reaction from Charles Murray. Here's a little introduction.
My dad had a high school education, started out as a repairman. I now am part of the new elite, but I grew up in a different kind of world. It used to be that American meant something to all Americans. That kind of common understanding of who we are and what we stand for is dissolving. And in the process, this country is coming apart. The direction in which we're heading will end what has made America, America.
So let me ask you something. Let's just, you know, there is constant propagandizing for things like, you know, it's the flavor of the month, the flavor of the week, flavor of the year. Lately, it's been transgenderism. If there was a huge wave of acceptance of transgenderism in America, let's just say from every corner, there was wild support. And, you know, the country took a lot of resources in putting into getting people to accept transgenderism as normal and to transition people from one gender to another. What would be the impact on life in America? What would be the impact? I'm just using one example that's come up in the news quite a bit. What would be the impact on the quality of life of not just the people who are transitioning, which according to statistics say that there's a high rate of suicide in these people, attempted suicide at least, what's going to be the impact on America? So is a country that does these type of things, is it better? Is it happier? I think it's worth asking because we want to know the direction we're headed. All right, I'm going to take a little break and come back to this story from Murray. I think you'll enjoy it whether you're on the left or right. It's at least kind of fascinating to listen to his opinion. 6:41, we got some local weather. All right, because of the lack of time in the show, I'm just going to dig into this. And Peter Robinson talking to Charles Murray about America's failing civic culture. I think that's what is the root here. And now this video is called Uncommon Knowledge, White America is Coming Apart. I see it as not a problem for white America. I think it's being expressed and reacted to by white America in part in some of these ridiculous Nazi movements and white nationalism. I think what you're getting at is that there was a core set of beliefs and ideas at the root of America that anybody could take part in. Now, in the beginning, black people couldn't take part because there was slavery. But because of our internal ideals that were expressed in the Declaration and the Constitution, those things were worked out, albeit through a civil war. But there was a consensus about what was life was about, and we've lost that. And transgenderism has become more important than a vast number of other issues that seem more central to keeping the country and satisfied. But anyway, here's this clip. Here's this a little. I won't be able to play the whole thing. 47 minutes, but I think you'll find the beginning of it interesting.
Close quote. With us today, Charles Murray, who I believe...
I'm going to start as close to the beginning as I can. Here we go.
From the new book, Coming Apart, quote, if the case I have made is completely correct, all is lost. Close quote. With us today, Charles Murray, who I believe will join me in hoping that he is not completely correct. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, shooting today in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Robinson. One of the country's leading social scientists, Charles Murray, is a longtime fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, right here in Washington, author of books that include Losing Ground, What It Means to Be a Libertarian, In Our Hands, A Plan to Replace the Welfare State, and The Bell Curve. Dr. Murray has just published Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. David Brooks of the New York Times.
This is from April 2012, published by PJ Media and YouTube.
Times quote, I'll be shocked if there's another book this year as important as Charles Murray's Coming Apart. Charles Murray, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Segment one, what we've lost. Coming Apart, quote, November 22nd, 1963, became the symbolic first day of what would be known as the 60s. The symbolic last day of the culture that preceded it was November 21st, 1963. We'll come to a detailed picture. I hope we have time to flesh it out in a moment. But first, can you reduce to a sentence or two what my children, what people who have no memory of those days need to know about the world that ended on November 21st, 1963.
There's nothing scarier than being asked to reduce to a sentence or two anything. I guess the sentence or two are this. First sentence is, I don't want to go back to 1963. I'd have to be dragged back there kicking and screaming because lots of good things have happened since then. Point number one. The second sentence is, however, there were things that we had in 1963 that we are in danger of losing irrevocably. And that is what is known as America's civic culture. Because in 1963, we had a common civic culture transcending rich and poor that was the direct descendant of the civic culture that the founders set up with the Constitution.
The and living was, felt culture of the country and was that, still directly we, in touch with
exactly.
The founders.
Peter, we still use the phrase the American way of life then. When was the last time you heard that, you know, in common use in the United States now? We don't talk about it anymore. But in 1963, people all knew what you meant when you said the American way of life.
On November 21st, 1963, the state of the American family, marriage rates, illegitimacy rate.
Everybody was married. Now, I'm going to refer in all of our conversations to non-Latino whites, and I might as well say quickly what I'm doing.
Please.
I'm going to be talking about social problems. And when you do that, when you include everybody, the natural response is to say, well, maybe Murray's really talking mostly about problems that are located in the African-American community, or perhaps it's a problem of illegal immigration. Non-Latino whites, as the base of your numbers, concentrates the mind wonderfully in terms of coming to grips with these problems, which I think it has succeeded in doing, judging from the reaction to the book. Anyway, you asked about marriage. If you had a high school educated blue collar person in 1963 who was ages 30 to 49, the odds were 84% that he was married, and the same, of course, to the women. In other words, it was the overwhelming norm. It was a little higher among the college-educated who were working in the professions. It was 94%, but it was the norm throughout society. 2010, you are down to 84% for the upper middle class, which is still quite high. You're down to 48% for the white working class. I mean, that is a sea change in a central cultural institution that has almost no precedent that I know of over such a short period of time.
Anywhere in human history?
I can't think of any where you've had such a central institution that's undergone such a profound change.
November 21st, 1963, workforce participation.
Let's talk about guys, because women at that time still were expected to stay home and keep the house and all that. If you were a guy and you were in your 30s and 40s, you either were working or you were looking for work, or you had better have a really good excuse, like being completely, totally physically incapacitated. If you weren't working and not looking for work at that age group, you were a bum. Your parents would tell you that. Your siblings would tell you that. Your wife, if you had one, would be appalled at it. That was all very simple then.
And again, November 21st, 1963, the state of religion in this country, or religiosity. What?
That's a strange story, because the church attendance had been going up since the 1920s, and it reached its apogee around the early 1960s.
Across denominations?
Across denominations. I'm talking about Christian attendance. And so it was very high at that point. Now, we don't have good numbers breaking down social classes and religiosity, but if I had to take a rough guess, you had about, well, we know for the whole population, it was about 50% said they had attended a worship service in the preceding week. That'll give you a sense of the degree of religiosity that exists with them.
And the religiosity is also connected to some basic sense of, you use the word often in the book, morality. These days, of course, we talk about ethics rather than morality.
Yeah.
You quote, for example, the motion picture code as it existed in 1963, quoted in Coming Apart. Motion picture code by which the major studios abided, quote, the subject of abortion shall be discouraged, shall never be more than suggested, and when referred to shall be condemned, close quote.
Taken for granted. You also did not show unmarried couples sleeping in the same room or any other way suggest that premarital sex was okay. Now, there were some movies in the early 1960s, including some I love, like Tom Jones, which got away with transgressing that code.
They were pressing the boundaries here.
Yeah, they were pressing the boundaries, but the way it was supposed to be back then.
Segment two, Belmont and Fishtown. In coming up.
Well, let's take a little break there. I think that's a good introduction. 652 Kelly O'Connell AM, Las Cruces AM, 1450 AM, 1450, 523, 1450. We'll be right back.
Turn up your radio.
Little Nate Bargatze for you.
Buddy, that was, it was unbelievable. I don't know. I've done comedy for a while. I've done a lot of different shows. They're not, they're not as all exciting as the Tonight Show. I did one in a prison once, like in it, like all the way in it. Like we went to them. I didn't like meet them out, you know. So we go in. Let's say you guys are the inmates. So I'm sitting here, I'm like doing my dumb jokes. None of it works. Every joke I have involves being outside in the past 30 years. Like, I'm like, traffic's crazy. You guys remember, people remember traffic here, right? So I'm doing my dumb jokes, and then an inmate gets up and starts walking towards me. I'm like, oh boy, here we go. You know, like he's going to use me to break out. And I don't want to point at him, but no one's like, look at, but I am using hand gestures. I'm like, what do you guys do on this side of the room? Should he be walking up like that? Turns out the bathrooms are behind me. He's a good guy. I judged him on what he was wearing and where we were at. It was my fault. So I'm like against a brick wall. And it's like goes like halfway up, and then the urinals are like all behind here. So then he comes to use the bathroom, and then he comes to the urinal right behind me. So then it's just me and him just looking at everybody, and he peed. He peed without even kind of a – it was the most confidence I've ever seen in my entire life. I thought, whatever you think this guy did it, all right? That's not – an innocent man doesn't pee like that. That's a guilty, I'm not getting out. I took social media off my phone. I don't, it's too much. Like you just, you know, you walk around and just look at it all day. They did Facebook. They did a good job. It's a real good company. And Facebook's just too much. Everybody, it's either everybody's best or worst days of their life. You know, like you're either like, I'm getting married or my house is on fire. No one's like, today's normal. Nothing happened. I have no strong opinions about anything. My wife gets mad because she's like, you don't like any of my photos on Facebook. And it's like, is this not enough, like us just being married and living together? And it's like, you know, how much, and I did like it. When we took it, I said, I like that photo. Like, I told you that. I'm in the photo. There's not much more than I can do in this photo's life. We've been married for 10 years, and we still fight. Like, you can, when you're married, fighting is open 24 hours, anytime. We got in a fight recently at 3 a.m. We woke up to get in this fight, and we...
All right, Nate Bargatze, we'll come back and pick up that story again. Kelly O'Connell, AM Los Cruces, 659, take you out with a little Van Morrison, Van the Man. Van the Man, an exciting performer.
Put on your electric light. Now we can get down.
What's really wrong?
Well, it's 7:06, and appreciate you tuning in this morning on the 15th day, halfway through August. It's supposed to rain yesterday. I didn't really see any myself, but so kind of going over a different angle on this white supremacy thing, which I think is it's a deeper issue. And I think the issue is that, number one, the country has gone through a sustained period of a lack of economic growth that has hit a lot of people. And during this same period of time, the media and the culture has become increasingly leftist, increasingly politically correct, whatever you want to call it. People feel, I think a lot of people, even some people on the left, feel like we've taken our eye off the ball and we're not doing what Americans used to do because we're distracted by all this garbage. So we were listening a little bit to Coming Apart by a conversation with Charles Murray. Now I want to switch gears to get into the issue of poverty as a possible spark on some of this nationalistic stuff. I think the loss of what America considered to be traditional values has had a lot to play in this, and much of it is related to declining economic fortunes for many people. Here's a little bit from PBS NewsHour, January 11, 2014. So I guess approximately 3 years ago.
Okay, so do you guys want to do the chocolate chip or the sugar cookies first?
By all appearances, Lee Scazzari is living a comfortable suburban life. She baked cookies one recent afternoon with her four-year-old twins at her mom's place in Shirley, Long Island, about 65 miles east of New York City. Scazzari owns an SUV.
Bye.
The girls spend their days at a nice daycare center, and Scazzari works a full-time job.
A lot of people look at me and they judge me just by looking at me like, okay, well, she has a job, she has a home, and her kids look very well taken care of. Why would she need any help at all?
Scazzari needs help because by official standards, she and her daughters live in poverty. Her job as a certified medical assistant pays just over $19,000 a year and offers no benefits. So Scazzari's on Medicaid, gets food stamps, and a government subsidy to pay for childcare she could never otherwise afford. This 30-year-old single mom lives in that two-bedroom house with her mother and pays rent. Her car has almost 200,000 miles on it and is in such bad shape, Scazzari says she's afraid to drive it.
I live paycheck to paycheck. That's what it is right now. Yeah.
Do you have any savings?
Typically, I have enough probably to get me through the next week or so. But as far as having a savings, no. I worry about not being able to have enough food to feed the girls. I worry about them not having the opportunities that other kids are going to have. So I'm constantly worrying. You know, I'm always worrying.
According to experts, stories like Lee Scazzari's are becoming more common across the United States.
There are now more poor residents living in suburbs than in major cities.
Elizabeth Kneebone is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the book Confronting Suburban Poverty in America.
Poverty in these kinds of communities can be hidden. It can be harder to identify or even understand the extent to which need has grown because it may not be easily visible.
Today, the nation's poverty rate is about 15% compared to 19% in 1964. When President Johnson declared the war on poverty.
Our aim is not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it.
Kneebone says since then, some aspects of the problem have changed dramatically.
When we saw the launch of the war on poverty, the geography of poverty was very different than what we're looking at today. The bulk of poor people in the country lived in urban areas, in big cities, or in rural communities. And since that time, we've seen a real shift.
According to Kneebone, since 2000, the number of poor people living in suburbs has grown by 65%. For example, poverty is up by almost 16% in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, up more than 27% in the suburbs of Providence, up nearly 79% outside Seattle, and in the suburbs of Austin, Texas, the number of poor has swelled almost 143%. More poor people now live in America's suburbs than in cities or in rural areas. The main explanation for this shift is simply demographics. Many more Americans have moved to suburbs in recent years, and that growth included low-income residents and new immigrants. Other factors? Suburbs are still recovering from the foreclosure and financial crises. Kneebone says federal programs for the poor were mostly designed back in the 60s with rural or urban communities in mind. And when hard times came to the suburbs, many were not prepared.
Often, suburban communities have not built up the same level of infrastructure and safety net supports that cities have been building up over decades.
Oh, boy. Where do I begin with the challenges?
Richard Kubek chairs the Welfare to Work Commission in Suffolk County, where Lee Scazzari lives. It advises the county legislature on issues affecting low-income residents. Local governments, already strapped themselves, face greater burdens in the face of federal budget cuts and the winding down of stimulus funds.
Suffolk County, in the last couple of years, has faced a $500 million deficit.
Even though Suffolk County has one of the highest median household incomes in the country and multi-million dollar homes in the Hamptons, the food stamp caseload has soared up 185% in the past 6 years. That's the case throughout much of America. Food stamp use up dramatically from coast to coast.
It can be very difficult, especially in this budget-constrained environment, to try and scale up to meet the level of need that they're seeing.
In Suffolk County, charities have stepped up as the local governments had a hard time meeting the demand.
Okay.
Food pantry organizers say they've seen numbers double in recent years, even in some of the county's most affluent towns. Carol Yarmish leads the Mercy House Food Pantry in Dix Hills.
We used to be one of a few food pantries, but now we're one of very many food pantries, and it's multiplying on a level that it's hard to comprehend.
Advocates say they're not just serving people out of work. They see many with jobs who can't make ends meet, just like Lee Scazzari. Nationally, real wages adjusted for inflation have been flat for several decades, even as costs continue to rise.
We also have these larger shifts in the economy where a lot of the jobs we're creating don't pay enough to make ends meet for a family. So even if you're working full time, you're just not taking home enough.
That's especially true in Suffolk County, where many working poor don't qualify for government help because they earn too much to be considered officially poor, around $23,500 for a family of four.
Despite our affluence, we have a lot of middle-income people who are struggling. We are one of the most expensive communities in the United States in terms of everything, gasoline, housing, food.
In 2012, Quebec's commission put out a study estimating that because of the high cost of living here, the poverty rate's at least 20%. That's three times higher than the official census figure of less than 7%. Another major problem and expense is transportation. In many suburbs, public transportation is limited. Until recently, buses in Suffolk County didn't run on Sundays.
If you're a working poor person, if you're, for example, a home health aide, many of them work on Sundays, what do? How do you get to work? Unless someone drives you, you take a cab, which could eat up 20 to 50% of what you're earning that day.
So many poor people, like Lee Scazzari, depend on their car. And car insurance and gas eat up about $600, more than 40% of the roughly $1,400 she takes home each month. And in case you're wondering, Scazzari's mom, who just turned 60, really isn't in a position to help. She's working two jobs to maintain the family home she inherited, and last year paid property taxes of around $7,000 on their small two-bedroom home.
So why do you stay in this house and in this neighborhood if it's so expensive?
Because my mother is the only family that I have. This is her home. She said she'll never leave here. I can't force her to want to leave just because the cost of living is inexpensive someplace else.
We do put on our socks like the girls.
Scazzari says she's also gotten no help from the twins' father.
The child enforcement is trying to help me locate dad. Before I even knew that I was pregnant with them, I got up one day and he was gone.
Some people might say, okay, the situation happened to you, but why should taxpayers help fund some of these programs that you are being helped by?
I mean, I started working when I was 12 years old. I've been working ever since. I've put into just as much, if not more, than what I'm asking for. You know, I understand the backlash. I really do. But at the same time, like, this is only temporary.
But for the moment, she's facing a catch-22. The more she earns, the worse off she might be. Because if she accepts the small raises she's been offered at her job, she'd earn too much to qualify for the child care subsidy. And if she lost that, she'd have to stay home with her kids, meaning she'd have no income at all.
A system that works against the system's own interest, it's just so counterproductive.
The Suffolk County Welfare to Work Commission's trying to address this and other issues affecting the working poor. It's pushed for more child care funding, held hearings to call attention to growing poverty, and helped get some public bus lines running on Sundays and later at night. Experts say it's critical for suburbs across the nation to recognize and address the changing face of poverty.
What we're seeing in terms of the growth in suburban poverty is a real pressing policy concern looking forward. If we think about the war on poverty, 50 years ago, when Lyndon Johnson declared this war, if everybody had known what was going to happen, what would we have done differently? This is our opportunity now for suburbs to answer those questions.
All right, so just the idea that, and there's more stories here, another one on people living in their cars in Walmart. There's a vast number of people that are doing that across the United States. Other stories about people living in their cars. I think that 60 Minutes has a 14-minute clip on that, but it seems like we have lost the core of what it means to be American. The economy has kind of flatlined, in part, I believe, because of bad policy and also globalism, this type of thing. And so people have lost their prosperity at the same time they've lost the sense of who they are as an American. And even if you think about this, with the gender wars going on, even a person's gender is under fire. The American family has changed, so we don't have the same, you know, identity in our family because many families are broken up or never existed. That lady that was just in that clip there had a couple of kids with a guy who then walked off and who pays for it. She does, but the kids pay for it especially. So we've got so many different issues going on. So we'll take a break here. 523-1450 and reload. 719 AM, Las Cruces AM, 1450 Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 if you want to add to this. I think this is an especially important issue for this area. We're so poor. Quarter of the people under the poverty line, quarter of the people just barely over the poverty line. We're just barely making it as we are here. Be right back.
Turn up your radio.
Hey, it's Kelly.
Hey, how are you?
It's Kelly. It's Kelly.
Hello?
Yeah, it's Kelly. Who's this?
Yeah, Kelly. This is Grant.
Hey, what's up, Grant?
Well, on the subject of poverty, I think one of the things that always is skipped over as if inconsequential is morality.
Hey, Grant. You want it? We're almost on the air. Let's bring it on the air, okay?
All right.
Okay, just hold on 1 second. And we do have Grant, and Grant was calling up to point out that success and morality go together. Go ahead, Grant. Grant. Hello. Grant, are you there? Grant, I hear you. I hear you scraping around. Can you say something? Hello? Grant, call back in. We must have lost connection. All right. So, but that's a good point. But here's the thing is that it's all tied in together. If America is miserable now, and Grant, we're waiting here by the phones. If America is miserable now, what's the cause of it? Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is Grant.
Hold on. Okay, Grant, hold on 1 second. Thanks for the call. Who's this?
Oh, good morning, Kelly. This is Steve.
Steve, hold on. I got Grant, and then I'll come to you, all right?
Okay.
All right. Grant, go ahead.
Yeah. What is always seems to be passed over as part of the repair to what we have created is this idea of morality.
All right.
That, you know, when I go and apply for a job, I go through a drug test, but somehow when somebody is struggling in poverty and my heart goes out to them, but this idea that you're going to help them with subsistence, which I am not in disagreement with,
okay.
What I am in disagreement with the no strings attached, no moral
yes.
equivalency, no pathway to success. And the pathway to success is morality.
Well, they did that in Florida, Grant. The governor said, I'm going to give the people on welfare on state aid a drug test. If you don't pass, you don't get it. And people were outraged, but it seems to have worked out there.
But again, they got outraged because they don't have a moral foundation. They do not think that there is anything wrong with having five babies by five different husbands. There's
yeah.
nothing wrong with that. It's just the circumstantial essential, you know, but existentialism.
But Grant, how in a country where gay marriage is now the law of the land, how do you argue for traditional morality?
That is the issue that is never addressed. There is no moral right and wrong. There's no black and white. There is, you know, only gray matter. That Hitler was just as righteous.
All right. Okay. All right. But there's another guy waiting to talk too. So make your point. What is the answer? What is the point?
Is I think that they need to readdress what morality is. What is, readdress it. Now, I don't think that the church should dictate everything of what morality is, but they need to bring the church into the equation.
No, but it has.
Say, hey,
Grant, hasn't the church itself failed?
Yes, they have withdrawn from society instead of being connected with the issues. But at the same time, they're being pushed out.
Right, but I mean, all right, so if you look at any Christian or any person who has an interest in what you're talking about, historian, they will tell you that the society falls when the church becomes inactive.
That's correct.
All right, great. Grant, I got to go. I got another call. Thanks for the call. Good call. Hey, Steve, how you doing? Good to hear you. What's going on? What's on your mind?
Look, Kelly, I was listening to your news feed, the story from Shirley. We have to, investigate and research. How do we help people that are working? But the problem with I always have is that it's accompanied by an agenda. And so they kind of offering this idea that public transportation is on Sundays is going to help this woman. But it's already been established that she doesn't use public transportation.
Right.
So they're just trying to get make.
Yeah, it's a propaganda.
Guilty,
yeah.
And that we're not providing the basics, and that this, is something that we can do. But if you look at it, I know Long Island. The population is so distributed so widely, there's no concentration that public transportation doesn't work. It's a huge subject.
Yeah, right, yeah, I agree. So what do you think of my idea that part of this white nationalism comes out of a loss of identity, that especially for white males have been told in the culture repeatedly for decades that they're morally inferior, that they are the root of the problem? And then they see that the work environment, the economy is changing. They're not as welcome. They're not a welcome in university system. They're not as welcome in many job applications. And then you see that your very style of life, like what Grant was saying there a little bit before, there used to be kind of a broad consensus of what it meant to be an American, and part of that was to go to church and generally be moral. All of that has been wiped out, and the economy, we don't have a robust economy like we used to. I think a lot of this is like kind of feeding into this white nationalism.
Yeah, and it was anticipated. The early writings in the early 70s, there was a lot of discussion about what's a postmodern society going to look like. And as we transfer to process, job, service economy, other things will come to play. And then other values will arise. The thing about the Southern heroes is all those old, antiquated cultural values of valor and lost causes, all of that is kind of really been minimized, marginalized.
And yeah.
They feel like their cultural values, what they've always believed in, is being rejected.
Is being rejected, so, but we've also... Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. But, what would be wrong with saying the success that America has had in the past and the enjoyment of being an American and being in the culture was all tied in with that?
Yeah, and it's funny because that's a main central tenet of Marxism, that the means of production will produce the value in the culture, not the other way around. So, and that's what I mean by that it was anticipated. I just used to read a lot of data way back in the 70s, that everything's going to change as our modes of production change, as our economy changes. And so that's what we're seeing. And, you're right, it's called alienation. I mean, that's Marxists have a field day with that term.
Well, and I mean, yeah, and I mean they do tie in wealth with prosperity with happiness, but I think that there is something that a lot of these white nationalists feel totally marginalized, and they say, we built this country, It was white Europeans who came over and built this country, and now it's being taken away from us. In the not only that, but the culture is failing, and I think that's in the minds of some of these nationalists.
I mean, they have wider issues. They have the individual psychological issues.
Yeah.
And it's going to get worse because basically the first principle argument isn't being defended by the media. They have the right to
freedom of speech.
They are.
Freedom of speech.
Right to protest.
Yeah.
They have the right to protest and gather. And, promoting the Antifa reaction to them. That's just fueling the fire.
That's true. Steve, I got to go for some local news. Thanks a lot. Good call. Have a good day.
Stay well.
Thanks. Yeah. All right. So, folks, without defending white nationalism, which is no different than black nationalism, these people are motivated by certain things. Look at blacks. See, they see that there's more violence and there is more police activity and incarceration in their community, and they're outraged. The whites are getting marginalized, pushed out of society, and told you're not needed here anymore, and they're outraged. So there is stuff that is leading to people to draw these conclusions, as mistaken as the conclusions are, and the society would do well to address it. And I think that Trump was riding that hope of a return to what many people consider to be a more normal America, historical America. Just my take. 7:33, Kelly O'Connell. Here's your local news.
Switch on your electric light. Then we can get down to what's really wrong, really wrong, really wrong.
And we have another call here. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Let me just start off this morning by saying Trump is at 34% approval.
Hey, Frankie, I can barely hear you. You're kind of fading in and out, which I would assume is your normal brain state. But why do you have to cheerlead for Trump's failure? I just find that so sickening. What if it was a show and just people called up all day, Obama's approval rating is 17%, thank God, instead of talking about issues. I mean, it is sickening to see the cheerleading for Trump to fail, no matter how it happens. Where is the praise for Trump standing, making the little Kim stand down? It's just anybody who just fantasizes about the leader of the United States failing just to fail just because they hate his guts. I mean, I disliked Obama for his policies, or I didn't personally dislike him. I didn't claim to know him, but I thought he had terrible policies and had a terrible attitude. But if he had, I would have been all in favor of him helping build the economy, which he obviously didn't do. I mean, the economy never grew at even 3%, even one quarter, but which has never happened before, but in an 8-year period like that. But I mean, I wasn't cheerleading that the guy would be hit by a car, but it seems like Trump was hated from before he came in, which seems, if you want to talk about howing, doing things the American way, is totally un-American. Give the guy a honeymoon period. Many of the things that he's working on are extremely important issues, but the left is so caught up in him failing, him getting brain cancer like McCain. It's sad. It is really sad that the left cares about issues and cares about principles as long as it benefits them. And as soon as it doesn't, they dump them overboard so fast. All right, so according to the ACLU, according to ProPublica, major sources, the police were caused to stand down in Charlottesville. And The outcome is that there was a lot of skirmishes. The idea that it was a peaceful demonstration until that guy drove his car into that crowd is totally false. But here's the issue. Why was there no police presence? That, according to Brittany Kane Conley, a minister in training who protested the alt-right rally, she told that to the New York Times. We were watching people punch each other. People were bleeding all the while. Police were inside of barricades at the park watching. It was essentially just brawling on the street and community members trying to protect each other. So within this context, you have one person who ups the ante and drives their car and ends up killing somebody, but it's not in the news. It's not in the news that there was fighting on both sides, which is wrong. You know, their reporting should be not just these white Nazis, these nutcases showed up and started, killing people. It should be that there was fighting going on all day long, and then one person really took it over the top and is now getting prosecuted for murder. So here's my question. What was the purpose of Terry McAuliffe, who's a very, very, very close friend of the Clintons? He was a money man for the Clintons. What was the purpose? Here is the worst case scenario in my mind. Here's the very cynical view of this. Terry McAuliffe wanted something terrible to happen to discredit the right, the alt-right, Trump or whatever. Is that possible? I have no idea. There had to be a reason, though, that he told the cops not to intervene. And they said it came from, they said that the stand down order came from up above. So the person who's above the police is the governor. And you can go and find it, ACLU, ProPublica. Police stood by as mayhem mounted in Charlottesville. That's ProPublica, which is an independent. So did the police non-action lead to ultimately mayhem, a public melee? Just want to know why this crap happens. But we've got a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connor Show. Who's this?
This is Aaron Kelly.
Morning, Aaron. Hope you're well, and what's on your mind?
Well, I've only seen this playbook before where in Baltimore.
Berkeley.
The police just did that.
Berkeley. It ended up in causing a regime of murder. The murder went through the roof when the bad guys saw that the police didn't want to get involved, in part because they were being criticized for overreacting, in part for going after black people supposedly. The police stepped back, and it made it 10 times worse. Correct.
We've seen it in city after city. And then, the whole idea that the left doesn't call out this anti-fascist crowd that are total fascists. They don't call them out for the violence. If that crowd had just stayed away and let these people just walk down the street and scream what they want to scream, everybody would have gone home at the end of the day and nobody would have paid attention to them anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's the answer?
The answer is going to be we're going to reach a critical mass point, and I think you're going to see more violence. A lot worse things are going to happen, unfortunately. I feel terrible about it because I think this whole culture of dividing America into all these little groups was perpetuated and brought on by the Democratic Party. They just took every disaffected group.
Yeah.
And
all right.
And turn them into a little army or mob.
Yeah, that's true. Aaron, I got to take a break for weather. Thanks for the call. All right, folks. It is a fact that the most important thing to Karl Marx was revolution. You couldn't have a new society without having a revolution. And this is the type of thing that the left is always auguring in. Whether you think that's fair or not, go back and look at history. Look at what was said at the graveside of Karl Marx by his writing partner, the person who knew him best in the world, Engels, who said the only holy thing to Marx was revolution. 744, we'll be right back. 745 on the button. Kelly O'Connell, AM Les Cruces, AM 1450, 523-1450. Marijuana news, but first I just want to finish up something that I think Grant was saying and Steve. Basically, we've developed a society, and I was just talking to somebody who had a leadership position in a company, and said that the younger generation has no compunction, they have no scruple, they will lie at the drop of a hat, and. You know, we've already kind of chronicled here this generation coming up seems different, disinterested in other people. And so I think very impatient. You know, having friendships takes time. It takes patience. If somebody doesn't tell you that it's important and the way that you avoid loneliness is to have friends, which is, I guess, the most obvious conclusion in history, friendship is not important to you. Then your life is going to be challenging. Now, how you would establish that in an argument, I think, is you would refer to the golden rule, which is what basically the philosopher, from what I gather, the philosopher Kant based his moral system on. I don't think Kant was a Christian, but he used this idea, the golden rule, as a way to measure out how people ought to act is kind of a mirror. Treating people the way you want to be treated is the measurement, because that's how you want to be treated. And so I think for a lot of people who are rude or dismissive or take for granted other people, they really can't know the importance of this type of thing or the impact of it until it happens to them. But we're not teaching people that's a standard. You know, when people use you, when they ignore you, when they treat you like you're a tool just to meet their needs, that's not a good thing, because when it happens to you, it feels terrible. And it just seems like this whole generation, which is not fair, I'm sure there's a number of lovely individuals in this generation, but it's become a hallmark, from what people tell me, of dealing with a lot of these individuals. And it's an absolute disaster. It's a moral disaster. Anyway, moving on. Just my opinion, 523-1450. There is no conclusive evidence, according to the Daily Mail in the UK, August 14, 2017, there's no conclusive evidence that marijuana helps with chronic pain and PTSD. A 20-year study finds U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs found an increase in PTSD symptoms from veterans who used medical marijuana. It makes it worse. Among patients who use medical marijuana, 80% use it for chronic pain, 33% for PTSD. And use for chronic pain can lead to increased risk of motor vehicle accidents and short-term cognitive impairment. Medical marijuana is allowed in 30 states, including D.C. The NFL is looking into medical marijuana use for its players in pain relief. Kind of interesting. Now, here's another, even more disquieting headline from the Daily Mail from August 4th, but 10 days ago, could marijuana really cause a mental breakdown? We explain how the drug affects the brain as Kanye West tour insurer refuses to pay for canceled shows and blames his cannabis use for his mental breakdown. And the 40-year-old rapper who's married to Kim Kardashian is asking for $10 million in damages from Lloyd's of London because of his canceled tour, because of his mental breakdown. The company says documents that they filed in documents that they're implying that Kanye's use of marijuana may provide them with the basis to deny the $10 million claim. Now, getting down in this article, it's the same article I was looking at. Okay, can marijuana use cause a psychotic break? Psychosis is defined as a condition that affects the mind and causes the sufferer to lose touch with reality. Symptoms include delusions and hallucinations, feeling of paranoia and suspiciousness, disorganized thinking and speaking, loss or decreased motivation, loss or decreased ability to initiate or come up with new ideas, difficulties expressing emotions. Studies have found that marijuana is thought to cause psychosis-like experiences by increasing a user's risk of depression. The two mental health conditions have been linked. Now, further, there is a connection between, there is a, whether it's cause or effect, there is a connection between marijuana use and schizophrenia. It could be that marijuana use is being used for self-treatment, but could, on the other hand, be that it's causing it. We don't know. But there's a very large link. 7:52, we'll take our last break and be right back. Finish her up. Mark Schiff, comedy.
An hour and a half he drove here. Look at him. He doesn't even have a car. You lying. Can't believe he does that every night. It took me a month to get here. I have no legs under these pants. But I got here anyway. Ah, took me 4 hours to get here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And I live right across the street. Traffic, I couldn't cross. So it is good to be here. Yeah, I love, you know, you talk about the driving, the cops. Look, when they pull you over, they say these things to you. Hey, you know you're doing 75 miles an hour? Yeah, when you leave, I'm doing 95, all right? I love this question. What's your hurry? I'm on my way to your wife's house, all right? Hey, step out of the car. Now, why don't you come sit with me a while? We'll go to my house. We'll take a bath. Come on, get in the car. I'll watch her bath. We'll take a bath. That's how you can get rid of anyone in life. Just ask them if they want to take a bath. They won't bother you. You're home. The Jehovah's Witnesses come to the door. You open the door. Hi, how are you? Money? Fine. You want to take a bath first? Why don't you hop in? Get the reading material. We'll have a good time. Come on. Let's go. Let's take a bath. I went to the 99-cent store. You know you're not doing well in life if you return things to the 99-cent store. That's a big problem. You drive back with a can of plums, you got big problems. And people get home, they go, this doesn't work. Uh-huh. It's from the 99-cent store. When they bought it, it didn't work then either. I bought shaving cream. There was no shaving cream. You just squeeze it, it goes. So somebody said go there. They actually had underwear, 40 pair of underwear, 99 cents. 40 pair. My head's telling me, sometimes the head tells you good stuff. It says, don't buy it. You're getting ripped. Just don't do it. Don't be an idiot. So I buy it. I get home. I put a pair on. The fly is on the side. Which for me is fine, but a lot of people can't handle this sort of thing. It's one of those things. I just happen to be lucky. Some people are gifted. You know, getting up in the morning is hard, isn't it? As soon as you wake up in the morning, you hear that voice in your head like, go back to sleep for a while. And you argue with yourself, I can't, I got to go to work. The hell with it today, come on, just relax, go to sleep, you're killing yourself, for what? Now fire me, you're thinking, I'll get fired if I don't go. So why, you don't like those people anyway. They're not paying you anything, they're ripping you off. Why don't you get a gun and go down there and take those people out? Take care of everything. My kids went parachuting the other day. They got an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old, they actually... from parachute. I'm trying to get my wife to go, but without the chute. This is not so easy. My wife sees everything, hears everything, smells everything. It's like living with a Saint Bernard. I'm in the other room. You farted. I'm like 11 rooms away. It's unbelievable. You know, before you get married, nobody tells you what it's like. You ever ask people what it's like, they go, you'll see for yourself. Yeah, but what's it like? You'll see. Are you happy? Let's put it like this. It's a different type of happiness.
All right, so anyway, Mark Schiff, you recycled a few jokes, but they're his jokes. Why not? Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you have a good day. 7:59 on the button. Little Van Morrison Caravan from the Last Waltz movie. See you back in 22 hours. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces. Ciao. Death Row Radio. We've got a few days left. Going on, it's got so loud.